on September 26th, 2024.
With the potential for significant impacts from Florida all the way to Tennessee. And the president wants to make sure that everyone is paying attention to the potential life-threatening impacts that this storm may bring.
FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell tried to prepare the nation for Hurricane Helene.
The entire state of Florida is under some type of warning right now, whether that's a hurricane warning or a tropical storm warning. And we expect life-threatening flash flooding in the state's north as the storm continues to move north.
A Category 4 hurricane with sustained winds of 140 miles an hour that developed and intensified into a major hurricane in just 4 days. Helene had its eyes focused on communities well beyond Florida, bringing torrential rain and flash flooding more than 500 miles inland from the Florida coast. Homes ripped from their foundations and washed away. People swept into the surging floodwaters, many of them killed.
I want to take a moment and sadly announce that we have, as of now, 36 confirmed deaths as a result of the storm. It's going up, and there will likely be more. We hope not.
South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster in the days after the storm.
Upstate hadn't seen anything like this before. We've had ice storms, but we've never had a hurricane.
North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper.
Towns wiped off the map, bridges damaged or completely destroyed, critical infrastructure and water systems, electrical grids, communications all remain seriously damaged. Countless homes and businesses that are lost. An entire region of our state is still in a dangerous situation.
And before those in the path of Helene had finished counting their dead.
Less than 14 hours, Hurricane Milton will make landfall on the western coast of Florida. Winds will be fierce at well over 100 miles per hour, with storm surges reaching up to 15 feet, up to 18 inches of rain.
We've been working around the clock to prepare for Hurricane Milton and to ensure that people are safe, including ensuring federal, state, and local resources are being coordinated in a smart and efficient and effective way.
Hurricane Milton, a raging monster of a storm that intensified so much and so quickly, it brought veteran Florida meteorologist John Morales to the edge of tears.
It has dropped 50 millibars in 10 hours. I apologize. This is just horrific. There's the Cat 5 information. Winds 160 miles per hour. Moving east-southeast at 9 miles per hour. And on that track.
2 weeks and one day after Hurricane Helene slammed into Florida's Big Bend region, Milton made landfall, thankfully decreasing in intensity to a Category 3 storm. But still, it was a hurricane with sustained winds of 120 miles an hour. And all this just a year after Hurricane Ian, as noted by Florida Governor Ron DeSantis.
When you go through one storm, it's tough. Then when you have more coming, and then you have a third one come in like 13 months in the same general area, not easy to deal with. So please keep those folks in your thoughts and prayers.
Milton and Helene, the 21st and 22nd billion-dollar weather disasters in the United States this year. We've had hurricanes for as long as we've been recording the history of the Americas. But two major hurricanes back-to-back, we're pretty sure that's new.
You know what's driving that. I don't need to tell you. Global warming, climate change, leading to this and becoming an increasing threat.
That's John Morales again, the Florida meteorologist who became emotional watching Milton rapidly intensify, and he's right. Climate change is creating more frequent, more devastating disasters, and in places you wouldn't expect, like deadly tropical storm rains in the Carolinas. Climate change is a crisis in every way imaginable, but it is hardest on our youngest disaster survivors, children. In fact, one pediatrician calls our inaction on climate change a crime against children, and she's written a book that's been described as a call to action on climate change. Let's talk to her. From Texas Public Radio, this is Petri Dish. I'm Bonnie Petri.
Support for Petri Dish is made possible by UT Health San Antonio, committed to transforming the health of the community through a team that tackles problems from every angle, doing everything it takes to bring each patient the best possible outcomes, from teaching tomorrow's healthcare leaders to translating research into new treatments. UT Health San Antonio strives to make lives better. Learn more at everythingittakes.org.
Right now, I am watching a video on YouTube taken by a guy named Kevin Brown on August 25th, 2013.
Some trees are going to come up right here.
It's a video of the Yosemite Rim Fire, a raging wildfire that took 9 weeks to contain and wouldn't be extinguished for more than a year. It burned more than 400 square miles, including a large portion of Yosemite National Park. In nearby Reno, Nevada, ash fell like snow.
Oh, yeah, it was like looking out at a moonscape outside. You know, there was just, because the ash just coated everything in that fire. And it's really hard to explain. I know New York and Chicago and some other areas last year had some smoke and got some experience with this. But here, you know, it got worse and worse over the decade, up to the point where we were spending 2.5 months in those kind of conditions.
Dr. Deborah Hendrickson is a pediatrician in Reno. And before becoming a doctor, she was an environmental analyst and planner. She says Reno is the fastest warming city in the United States. But the heat isn't the biggest climate concern people in that city face right now.
The biggest impact here of climate change has been wildfire smoke. And about 11 years ago, we had the first in what would turn out to be a series of catastrophic smoke crises, something called the Yosemite Rim Fire. And I was in my clinic, and this little 10-month-old girl came in wheezing and coughing with, you know, with her mom. And outside the window, you know, ash was just falling from the sky like snow and swirling around the building. And it was just this apocalyptic scene. And this baby just looked up at me with these big brown eyes as she was struggling to breathe. And my background in environmental science, I'd done graduate work in forestry also. So I knew the fires were linked to and were a prediction of climate change. And I just looked at her and I thought, this is climate change right here in front of me in this little baby's visit to my clinic. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to kind of zoom out from this moment and talk about these global processes and zoom into the microscopic processes of her body, like how these huge global events are tied to this one little girl's visit to the pediatrician. And that's how the book started, and that's how I started working and getting active in climate change as a health issue.
Hendrickson's book is called The Air They Breathe, A Pediatrician on the Front Lines of Climate Change, and it details the impact of climate change on children's health.
Yeah, to be clear, these events are not good for anybody's health, but children are especially vulnerable to environmental injury. And one of the things I mention in the book is that pediatricians often say that children are not just small adults. And we say that because Their physiology, the way their bodies work, is actually quite different in ways that makes them more susceptible to environmental harm. You can't just like take the same calculations and assumptions you would for an adult and just downscale them for size. And so, like, just as an example, like small children breathe faster than adults and they have more lung surface area per pound. And that just means they're exposed to more air pollution per pound than an adult is. So just as an example, you know, they're smaller. And so that has all kinds of repercussions. They're going to heat up faster in a heat wave. In a car, they're going to heat up faster than an adult. They're not as able to help themselves. They depend on adults, for example, to get them evacuated or out of a flood. One of the most important reasons children are more susceptible, though, is that their organs are still developing and growing. In fact, some organs' development depends on interaction with the environment. And the two I talk about the most in the book are the lungs and the brain, because they literally develop through interaction with the air they breathe and the environment around them. So that's part of where the title comes from. And, you know, kids just have more life years in front of them. So anything that they experience in terms of an injury is just going to have much more impact. And this combination of things has led one group of researchers to estimate that about almost 90% of the global disease burden from climate change is actually occurring in those less than 5 years old. So it's really disproportionately a burden we're putting on kids' health, you know, as well as the fact that they're going to have to live with the impacts of what we do to the world.
So let's begin with the health concerns highlighted in your book's title, those related to a pretty essential thing, which is, of course, breathing.
In wildfire smoke, the most concerning pollutant is particulates. And there's literally a mountain of evidence about the dangers of particulates to human health. But for children, they are particularly dangerous because of this issue of developing organs and bodies. So we know that pregnant moms who are exposed to particulate pollution, like when we have these terrible smoke events here, that the particulates actually pass through the mom's lungs and travel through her blood and cross the placenta to the fetus. They transport to the fetal side of the placenta. And that babies who are exposed to these have all kinds of health implications. We've tied it to later risk of childhood cancers, hypertension, diabetes, autism, ADHD. There's all kinds of impacts from prenatal exposure alone. But 80% of lung development happens after birth. So kids who are raised in areas with chronic particle pollution, like the most polluted neighborhoods of Los Angeles, they tend to develop smaller, stiffer lungs. So they have reduced lung capacity. And that can have lifelong implications for their lifespan, for their health, for their job prospects. So again, it's the lungs and the brain that are very affected by this chronic exposure to particulates. And most of this research actually comes from fossil fuel particulate research. And one of the points I like to make is that I think is really important to understand is that even if fossil fuels were not causing climate change, the health implications, especially for, you know, certain vulnerable groups like children, are so huge that I think if most parents really understood how these pollutants are affecting their kids day to day, it would really generate a lot more support for switching off of them. You know, like any pediatrician can tell you, we get constant questions about vaccines and autism, which of course has been disproven that there's no established link between vaccines and autism. I have yet to meet a single parent who knows about the growing evidence that there is a link between fossil fuel pollution and neurologic impacts like autism, ADHD, and learning and cognitive problems in kids. And I mean, it's really shocking the amount of stuff we're learning about that.
Yeah, I think it's really important to underline that particulate pollution is everywhere, not just, you know, places where there are wildfires. And I do think that if parents knew more about the very real threat posed to children's health by fossil fuel pollution, they might start fighting as hard for clean energy as some do for skipping vaccines. So keep the vaccines, dump the fossil fuels. Let's move on to the warming in global warming. The planet is getting warmer, and cities like Reno and San Antonio are already dangerously hot a lot of the time.
For heat, small children, like I said, they're smaller, so they heat up faster. They have fewer sweat glands that activate more slowly. They have less blood volume with which to dissipate the heat to the outside world. So they just have a lot of physiological reasons. And their metabolism is faster, so they generate more heat per pound on their own that they have to vent to the outside world. And when it's hotter outside, they have more trouble with that. And their judgment about whether they're in danger from heat, that's an issue all the way through the teenage years, is a problem too that puts them more at risk of heat risk. In terms of the hurricanes that just happened, the thing we worry about is because of brain development. If a young child is exposed to a really traumatic event, you know, most kids are resilient and they're going to be fine with a lot of support and help from their parents. But because the brain is undergoing rapid development and growth in early life, if the family experiences a natural disaster that damages or destroys their home and maybe results in injury or death to a family member or a pet or a neighbor, and the kids witness this, you know, it can create what's known as toxic stress.
Okay, I'm going to put a pin in toxic stress there. I definitely want to talk more about that. But right now, just take me back to September when Helene formed and you first heard about it. What were your thoughts?
Well, in those storms, I mean, the first thing, of course, is physical injury. And there were some kids injured and worse in the storms, in Helene at least, that parents are getting their kids out of the way and protecting them and evacuating out of any zone that might be in danger. The problem with Helene was, of course, I think people just really had no clue how bad it was going to be so far from the coast up in the mountains. But so the physical safety of the kids is the first and primary thing, is getting them out of the zone. And that kids are with their parents during these events, the parents are most likely to protect the kids and get them out of there. And when kids are separated during a disaster, that can increase the risk of emotional trauma later.
Which neatly brings us back to toxic stress. So this is top of mind right now because of the two hurricanes in 2 weeks that both reached major hurricane status and took aim at the same area. So stressful is an understatement, I think, for a situation like that. It must feel like living in a literal war zone.
Right, right. There are kids who, especially in certain parts of the country like the Gulf, are living through them repeatedly. The most important thing is how the parents are coping with the event. You know, kids really absorb and reflect how their parents are doing. It's kind of like that airplane advice, you know, put on your own mask first. And of course, nobody's made of stone, and it's very difficult to cope with these things. But if parents can be kind of attentive to their own functioning and how they're reflecting to the kids, it can help. But the other important thing is what happens to the kids during and after the event, you know, what they witness and how they and what happens to the family afterward if they're homeless, you know, if they live in shelters. But the big red flag, the most important thing, is what kind of history the kids have before. So to your point, if they've been through another disaster before, it's a red flag that they're going to have more trouble in a subsequent disaster. Or if they have a history of, say, the loss of a parent or abuse or neglect or some other kind of trauma like that or a major medical problem, they're the ones who are going to need the most help afterward to try to get through it.
So how can adults offer that support before, during, and immediately after the disaster?
Emotionally, I think the most important thing is to sort of give the kids a message of reassurance. You know, you tell them you're going to stay with them and protect them, that you're going to be okay. You know, whether you believe it or not, you just try to keep giving them that message that we're going to be okay. You know, I'm going to protect you. We're going to get through this. And give the kids a sense of agency and competence too. You know, if there are tasks they can do, like if you have to evacuate, give them a bag and say, can you pack up those things? You know, get them involved and give them a sense of some control over what's going on. I think those are the two big ones. If the kids are having emotions like being sad or having outbursts of anger, help them identify their feelings, you know, give a name and a label to it. Like, you seem angry, you seem upset. You know, I understand that we have to do this though right now, you know, and just try and direct them.
Dr. Hendrickson, in the book, you also talk about how kids are grappling with climate change in a sort of existential way, you know, thinking about it in terms of their potentially lost futures as the climate situation around them continues to deteriorate.
Yeah, it's that is very difficult, right? Because it's not like they're wrong about what's happening. But I think, again, it's kind of the same message as I was saying with the hurricane. And it's the same message for all of us. You know, I think we have to not sink into this kind of learned helplessness or despair about it and recognize that we do have some agency even now over what happens next. And we have to do all we can to combat what's happening and try to reduce fossil fuel use to prevent these storms from continuing to get worse and worse. Getting involved and doing something is the antidote to that anxiety and despair, and joining with other people who are doing the same, like getting teenagers together who are all worried about this and having them come down to the Public Utilities Commission and talk to the commissioners about why we shouldn't be building a new gas plant, but instead should be installing megapack batteries to store energy in the grid, and why we should be upgrading the grid. So if you can get the teenagers involved in public issues that are actually going to address the problem, that's really the best way to deal with it. Because it is, it's a scary and difficult thing, and they're not wrong to be worried.
No, they're not wrong.
This is a crime against children. It's really the greatest crime ever committed.
We'll talk about the crime and the criminals and what we can do to help our kids have a healthier future when Petri Dish continues.
Support for TPR comes from the University of Texas at San Antonio's Brain Health Consortium, a pioneering research hub advancing neuroscience, neuroengineering, precision medicine, and more. Learn more at utsa.edu/bhc.
Welcome back to Petri Dish. On Sunday, August 28th, 2005, the people of New Orleans heard this familiar sound that will never not create a sense of panic in a person from my generation. I'm warning you so that you don't panic right now. What they heard next still makes my blood run cold.
Devastating damage expected. Hurricane Katrina, a most powerful hurricane with unprecedented strength. Most of the area will be uninhabitable for weeks, perhaps longer. At least one half of well-constructed homes will have roof and wall failure. All gabled roofs will fail, leaving those homes severely damaged or destroyed.
I happened to be at work in a newsroom, and I read the alert from the National Weather Service when it came across what we in news call the wire. The wire is a steady stream of news from the Associated Press, and the bulletin continued. Airborne debris will be widespread and may include heavy items such as household appliances and even light vehicles. Persons, pets, and livestock exposed to the winds will face certain death if struck. Power outages will last for weeks, and most power poles will be down and transformers destroyed. Water shortages will make human suffering incredible by modern standards.
A very strong hurricane, the strongest it can actually be. And all you have to do is take a look at the satellite picture. This is extreme to catastrophic, including New Orleans, including Pasco.
Reading that again now, I'm immediately transported back. It was really awful. And while, like Milton, Katrina weakened before making landfall, it did ultimately devastate New Orleans. The city is, of course, below sea level, and when the levees failed, 20% of the city was submerged. More than 1,800 people died. Now, there was a mandatory evacuation order for New Orleans, but tens of thousands of people couldn't leave because they couldn't afford to, or because they were disabled, or for some other reason. But 2 days after the storm, when it became clear that the city would be, like the National Weather Service warned, uninhabitable for the foreseeable future, 25,000 people wedged themselves into buses and headed for my city at the time, the Astrodome in Houston, Texas. Nearly 5,200 kids were separated from their families during the storm. And it took 6 months to reunite them and find them all because the disaster scattered people everywhere.
I'm looking for my mom. My mama, if you are still in New Orleans, I love you. I hope you're safe. Grandma.
They were extreme weather refugees, and tens of thousands were never able to go back home. They stayed in Houston. You know, especially during this election cycle, we hear a lot of talk about refugees seeking asylum at the southern border. One of the candidates' campaign is sort of built around stopping refugees from entering the country and deporting many of those who are already here. But as the climate crisis unfolds, even if we decide to start fighting climate change right now, we will definitely see more of that internal migration from places like New Orleans to Houston or Tampa Bay to anywhere that's not being hammered by hurricane after hurricane, or from Reno to anywhere where smoke isn't choking your children. We're talking with pediatrician Deborah Hendrickson, author of The Air They Breathe, a pediatrician on the front lines of climate change. Dr. Hendrickson, how does a doctor prepare for an influx of climate refugees?
That's a good question because, yeah, migration causes a lot of stress for kids too. You know, we talk a lot about immigrants and migration, but a lot of that's being driven by climate issues in Central America, of course. I think just in the same way we talk about the impacts on kids from these events in general or trauma in general, just trying to create as much stability as we can for them, reassurance. If kids are, for example, moving from Florida because their homes have been destroyed once or twice, hopefully, you know, if they come here, they're going to be in a stable environment for a while and we can help them get through that. But helping the parents' mental health too, that they're getting the resources they need, you know, especially, like I said, low-income parents, that they have the disaster assistance to reestablish a residence, get transportation, get food. So whatever you can do to provide stability for a family helps children. And so that would be the big thing, is just stability and continuity as much as you can for the kids.
Are medical schools preparing future doctors for this?
That's a really good question. And a lot of medical schools have been adding climate change health impacts to their curricula, but it varies a lot by school in terms of how much and what topics they're emphasizing. But that is an ongoing movement in the medical education community of trying to bring medical students up to speed to recognize these impacts and to treat them appropriately, and also to become advocates for fighting for prevention, which has two parts to it. One is adaptations we can take to protect people in a, you know, from the impacts we know are already here, and mitigation or sustainability, trying to prevent fossil fuels from making things worse, and involving the medical community in that as well. So yeah, in fact, I'm involved right now in trying to get a climate curriculum at our medical school here, but a lot of the top name schools have already done that. I don't know if anyone has particularly focused on the migrant issue, but I would imagine that somebody has addressed that in their classwork.
I know a lot of people are trying to figure out how to get ahead of the crisis and move to safer places, but the recent devastation in the Carolinas and beyond is a reminder that climate change is really going to hit all of us. There really is no safe place, right?
No, I know. People ask me often, like, well, where should I move? And it's like, well, it's sort of like pick your poison, like what kind of impact did you know, like here it's mainly air quality that we're experiencing, but the summers are getting hotter too. You know, we never used to have, it was rare to have a day that was over 95 degrees here when I first moved here 30 years ago. And now half of July can be over 100, you know, and the fire is a risk everywhere out here. You know, I don't know anybody in the West who hasn't tried to figure out what they would grab and run with if they got woken up in the middle of the night because of a fire. So that's millions of people who are thinking about that all the time. It just depends where you are, what you have to worry about. So the Gulf and the East Coast, yeah, it's flooding and hurricanes are the big risk. So no place is going to be spared. It's just, you know, what kind of impacts we're all going to see, which is, I know, awful, but we have to do what we can, because what's the alternative? You know, because a lot of us have kids and we care about the kids, and to just, you know, try to imagine any other moment in American history where we would just kind of shrug and do nothing. Like, I often talk about December 1941, the Pacific Fleet had been destroyed at Pearl Harbor. Hitler had conquered most of Europe. And yet less than 4 years later, the Allies had won the war. And it was because everybody joined together toward that goal of, like, what seemed like an impossible goal at the time, but, you know, or getting to the moon, which took less than a decade after JFK gave his speech. You know, I think if we could all get on the same page, which, you know, given how divided we are, it's a big ask. But it's not that it's impossible. It's just a matter of human will.
How do we get on the same page?
This is a crime against children. It's really the greatest crime ever committed. I mean, a group of powerful people 50 years ago and multiple times since decided for everyone else on Earth, for billions of people born and unborn, that they were going to change the Earth, you know, so that they could profit in the short term. And I think once parents really absorb that, I'm hoping, you know, that this is a daily and ongoing crime against their kids' health now and the future of everyone forever. And that if we don't act quickly, we have this decade to act, really, to have a chance of staying, and of course the chance is diminishing every day, but have a chance of staying at that 1.5 degree centigrade rise above pre-industrial temperatures that will tip us into, you know, at least the models show, tip us into a kind of a different world. That there's this real urgency to acting right now. I did want to say, you know, it is true, like, this is the world we're in now, and we can't undo what's happened. But I think it's important for people to understand, too, that the modeling has shown that if we stopped carbon emissions today, that the world would stop warming in 3 to 5 years. That's what the modeling shows. So this, it's not like this would go on for decades, that we actually have a chance to steer the Titanic away from the iceberg by doing something really quickly and really dramatic.
Okay, let's steer. What do we have to do to stop this world from warming in 3 to 5 years?
This is not a technological issue anymore. This is solely a political issue. And analyses have shown this. I mentioned in the book that Stanford did a study of 140 countries and showed that it was entirely feasible to transition to clean energy within this time frame that we have, and it would save trillions of dollars in damages, that it was just a political problem. And so political problems can be solved by political pressure. But, you know, I don't want to minimize or be a Pollyanna either about it. Yeah, these are difficult things. And I think some of it's rooted in just basic human psychology, too, you know, that we respond to immediate reinforcers, right? So that profit for the people who are profiting from the status quo and from fossil fuels, that's what's driving their behavior. So changing the profit, you know, motive, or making somehow stopping subsidies to fossil fuel companies that make them continue to be competitive with much, like, solar is much cheaper now, but because we subsidize fossil fuels so much, they remain competitive against cheaper technologies. So if we stop those kinds of things and set up the contingency so that they encourage transition, that's one other thing we can do. I mean, you know, and starting small to, like, your local school, your house, you know, there's things we can all do in our own lives, like helping your school get an electric school bus, helping the school switch to solar power and heat pumps. You know, all these little things, every pound we keep out of carbon we keep out of the atmosphere is something.
And then the adults get to feel agency, too.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, because it's been a strategy of the fossil fuel companies, right, to try to make people feel like it's hopeless. You know, the doomer narrative, you know, don't bother fighting because it's all over. But that serves them well, too. So I would just say, don't give into it and keep fighting. You know, whether we win or not, you know, we have to fight to the end and do what we can.
Your book is being called A Call to Action. So what exactly is the action you are calling us to?
It's to do all we can to end fossil fuel pollution for the sake of our kids and every kid on Earth, and really all living things on Earth. The risks are to every home in the country, every family in the country, every child. And are we going to let these industries, this industry, destroy our kids' health and future for profit when there are alternatives that are right in front of us and available? Are we going to let that happen? Or are we going to fight for a better world, for the possible world that I describe in the closing pages of the book that we could have for them?
You mentioned starting small, which is really all most of us are able to do, at least right now. What does that look like?
I like to talk about it like in spheres. If you start with your own house and your own life, just taking a mental inventory of the role that fossil fuels have in your own life, like your car, your heating, your water heater, Because most of us aren't even thinking about these things when we flip on the hot water or turn on the lights. Like, where's this coming from? So just kind of getting to know your own contribution, then move out to your neighborhood. Like, how does electricity get here? What's the school getting its power from? Could we get an electric school bus? Then moving to your city, and what can you do at the city council and your state? What can you do at the Public Utilities Commission? Deal with what you can, but kind of move out from those spheres and talk to your neighbors, see what they're willing to do. But I think letting this be a kid's problem to lead, they should be involved and they should be doing what they can, but we can't just shrug it off on them. I think we have to lead too and be involved.
We cannot leave it all to poor Greta Thunberg. We've got to roll up our sleeves as well.
I did want to just mention, for parents who are in the hurricane zones, there's a book series called the Trinka and Sam book series that's put out by the National Child Traumatic Stress Network. It's stories for kids to help them get through disasters. I think they have a wildfire edition and a hurricane edition. And they can just kind of, they just provide some structure for a lot of the issues we talked about today to help kids learn about getting through these things.
Okay, we'll put a link to that on our website, tpr.org. Parents of young children should all have something like that in their library. Thank you, Dr. Deborah Hendrickson, author of The Air They Breathe, a pediatrician on the front lines of climate change. And come back for our next episode, where we will go even deeper into the mental health toll that climate change is taking on children. That's the next Petri Dish. I hope you will join us for that. This episode of Petri Dish was produced by Jacob Rosati, TPR Vice President of News Dan Katz, and me, and it was edited by Yvette Benavides. I wrote the show, and Jacob Rosati composed all of the music and created the sound design. Petri Dish is a production of Texas Public Radio. I'm Bonnie Petri. Talk to you soon.